Welcome to the New York Times podcast. I'm a businessman. Actually, in fact, I don't even have an LLC. It's true. Of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
And you know better, nigga. I know you do. But you gotta do better, boy. You owe it the blue. You had no father. You had the armor. But you got a daughter. Gotta get softer. Die, Jay-Z. This ain't back in the days. You don't need an alibi, Jay-Z. Cry, Jay-Z. We know the pain is real, but you can't heal what you never revealed. What's up, Jay-Z? You know you owe the truth to all the youth that fell in love with Jay-Z. You got people you love, you sold drugs to. You got high in life, that's your drug.
A lot of people make a lot of money in the music business, but they are not always the people that you think are making the money or even the people that you believe should be making the money. I want to talk about money. And when I want to talk about money, I want to talk to Ben Cesario, who is the music business reporter of the New York Times. Ben Cesario, let's get that guala talk.
You want to talk about money, huh?
Hell okay. Yeah.
Let's do it.
We're going to do two parts in this conversation. We are going to open up. We're going to talk about the recent story that you and Graham Boley reported about Live Nation and Ticketmaster and anti-competitive practices in the live event space. And then later on, we're going to talk about Spotify. These are two megalith business stories.
Let's do it.
Your beat is hot right now. It's hot. It's pulsing. I feel the yen and the euros just pulsing through your system right now. Is that accurate?
I feel especially the yen.
They're feisty. The yen. Okay, so let's start. You and Graham dropped a big old piece of reporting a few days ago about Live Nation and Ticketmaster, and especially in regards to potential antitrust issues. So there was a merger. When was that merger?
It was 2010.
Okay. And one of the conditions of the merger of Live Nation and Ticketmaster is that they would not make things more expensive for consumers and that they would not make the sort of ecosystem more hostile to competitors in the live event space. There's a
correct
a
on number two, okay. Not really correct on number one.
Okay.
The official rules by the government and antitrust stuff is extremely complicated and wonky, but it doesn't say anything about prices when the government approved the merger. But the head of the antitrust division at the DOJ, who was a lady named Christine Varney, and also the two executives of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, they both at the time came out and they said, this is going to lower prices. Mm-hmm. This is going to lower fees. They gave testimony to Congress, very skeptical Congress at the time.
They said it under oath.
They said versions of this in speeches, mm-hmm. and they said it was sort of necessary for the business under oath in the Senate. But the statements that they made about prices were not under oath.
Okay. Conveniently.
Yeah. But they sold this to the public as something that would benefit consumers.
Okay. Let's talk about who really benefits, which is Live Nation and Ticketmaster.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They benefit.
What is it? What's in it? Just from a conceptual, let's sort of pull back. Can you explain to someone like myself that is not privy to the sort of ins and outs of these businesses, why would a management agency and touring agency and a ticketing business want to be in bed together officially?
I think the official term is vertical integration.
True story.
And it's about when you combine pieces of a supply chain together, you can do everything more efficiently and you can make more money.
Right.
So if you own the farm where you grow the beans and then you mm-hmm. own the bottling plant and then you own the Coke trucks and then you own the vending machines, you can make more money selling Coca-Cola.
Right.
Or you can just
lower the prices and everybody. But that's, you know, hey, that may be asking too much.
Live Nation and Ticketmaster, the reason it works is that they're both in the business of like putting on and selling things for live events. Mm-hmm. Putting on concerts is very expensive, especially when you get to the really big level of stars and major tours and Madison Square Garden and big festivals and stuff. And so I think what a lot of people don't realize is that you don't actually make much money putting on a concert. That when you sell a ticket for $100 and then you tack $20 in fees on it, most of the $100 goes to the talent.
Yeah.
And then whoever is putting on the concert, they get whatever's left over from that. Mm-hmm. But then they got to find other ways to make money. And so Live Nation is very, very good at finding all these other ways to make money. They sell popcorn, beer, parking at the venues.
Yes.
They sell sponsorship, which not only means you know, the big brand on top of the stage, but there may have been an ad on Ticketmaster when you bought the ticket originally. Mm-hmm. There may have been a sponsor for the whole tour. There may have been a special deal for all the pre-sales and all that kind of stuff.
Does the artist see any of that money?
Usually not, but I think it's complicated. They may have their own sponsorship deals.
Sure, okay.
But when it comes to like Mercedes-Benz presents the concert series at Jones Beach or whatever, mm-hmm. I don't think the artist is getting that.
Got it.
And then there's tickets.
Yeah.
And the ticketing fees, that extra $20 that they tack on, that's like pure gravy. There was a time years ago when it was a more expensive business to sell tickets. You mm-hmm. had to have people at windows, people manning phone rooms and stuff.
The Ticketron
mailing
windows.
Yeah.
I have a memory of going to a Ticketron window and maybe at the Garden in the 80s.
Probably. I think Ticketron was bought out by Ticketmaster at some point as, you know. And then the fish got bigger and bigger and bigger. But there used to be more expense that went along with selling a ticket. Now it's pretty much all online.
It's fluid.
The expense is greatly reduced, but the cost has not come down.
Right.
And so the venues make a huge profit from the fees. And Ticketmaster itself also makes a lot of money from the fees. About half their earnings, which is not exactly the same as profit, mm-hmm. but about half the money that they can point to as saying these are profitable endeavors, that comes from ticketing.
Directly from, okay. And so Ticketmaster has a deal with certain venues.
Yes.
And Live Nation promotes tours.
Yes. They also own venues.
They also own, correct, yeah. So those things, historically, pre-merger, or even in the recent years, there's some overlap there, but it's not a total clean overlap between – it's not a one-to-one relationship between venues that Ticketmaster has deals with and Live Nation books and or owns.
In fact, Ticketmaster used to be called Switzerland, that they were not really in the game of running the venues, putting on the tour, right. managing the artists. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of reasons that Ticketmaster got beat up. That's actually kind of part of their job is like – people think that they're the one taking the money out of your pocket, but there's other parties involved there, and they're kind of used to taking the beating there in public.
Right.
But they were just there to sell everybody's tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that came up with the merger, and this was something that we didn't go into in our story, is that all of these competitors to Live Nation really didn't like the idea that they were doing business with Ticketmaster, selling their tickets, but now – the person who is selling their tickets is also their direct competitor.
Right.
Do they have our data? Are we benefiting our direct competitor by using this? We may not have a choice since the venue mm-hmm. tends to be the entity that has the deal for the ticketing. So there was a bit of fighting over that, but that was 8 years ago.
Right.
People still complain about that in the concert business, that a competitor to Live Nation doesn't necessarily like having to deal with Ticketmaster.
What was the impetus to do this story at this moment? Because obviously it's been 8 years since the merger. One of the things you guys talk about in the piece is a Matchbox 20 tour that maybe previously would have gone to one venue but ended up going to a different venue because of the change in ticketing partner. Am I correct in that?
That's what's asserted by the people in the story. Yeah.
Yes, right. So why are there a number of these cases right now? And people in your story, you say – investigators are starting to look into that. Who's doing the looking and what are the cases in so much as you can say?
The story tracks a bunch of anecdotes, some of which go back about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And there's others that are quite recent that were just about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that made it particularly current was that the Department of Justice, we know, has been looking into this.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that they were doing that because we have a new administration.
Yeah.
And Trump's Justice Department has come out publicly and said they really didn't like the way the Obama administration did these merger deals and these consent decrees particularly because it sort of forced the government to be a policeman going forward for years and years. And that's part of what the Live Nation consent decree is all about. To get back to your first question,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't say you have to reduce prices.
Yeah.
But it says Live Nation and Ticketmaster – you can't punish a venue for not using Ticketmaster. If they decide not to use it and to use a different ticketer, you can't deny them concerts in a retaliatory way.
Right.
But it's a really fudgy consent decree that's been criticized by a lot of these antitrust experts and even people who are in government now. because the very next line of this thing says, but even though they can't do that, you still can bundle your services and make business decisions however you see fit.
So, bundle the combined merge yes. services.
And you are allowed to make decisions about where concerts go based on your business decision and what makes the most economic sense for you.
So you can't retaliate. You can't retaliate. But you can make a business decision.
So as long as something is justifiable as a business decision, which basically means you can make more money, and as long as there is no proof of retaliation, mm-hmm. meaning you're doing something solely for the purpose mm-hmm. of punishing somebody else, then it's not a violation of the decree.
So you want to talk about the email contents, the AG emails?
Sure.
So explain a little bit about that, because that was obviously one of the real striking moments in the piece where there appears to be very like red siren-y retaliatory or implications of retaliation.
It's about that Matchbox 20 concert.
Yeah.
And we saw an email chain, one of a number of ones that we saw during the reporting of this story.
And this was provided by AEG.
This one was, yes.
Yes.
And this is a venue that used to be a Ticketmaster venue. And then they switched and they started using AEG's system, which is called Access. The year they switched, this Matchbox 20 show goes to another venue in Atlanta. And the guy booking the place is emailing with Live Nation's talent booker or talent coordinator there. And he's saying, don't abandon us. And he says, why didn't we get this concert? If there's an issue, let's address. And she said, issue? Three little letters. And the implication, of course, is that she means AEG.
Well, that's because Matchbox 20's popping. And if you don't believe me, get into 3 a.m.
She said it's cold outside and she hands me a raincoat. She's always worried about things like that. She said it's all gonna end and it might as well be my fault. And she only sleeps when it's raining. And she screams and her voice is straining. And she says, baby, it's 3 a.m., I must be lonely. She says, baby, well, I can't help but be scared of it all sometime. And the rain's gonna wash away, I believe it.
There's another email that we saw from slightly later, but around the same time, where the same guy who sent this is yelling at both AEG and Live Nation, telling them, you need to be giving us more concerts. You're not giving us enough. And then he says, Live Nation told us that they were going to put us in a literal boycott. So they were expecting it from them. But they were also yelling at AEG saying, why aren't you giving us more?
Yeah, sure.
But the fact that the guy said, they told us they were going to put us in a literal boycott seems to be
yeah.
an indication that that might have been a consent decree violation.
Though there's no email from Live Nation that says we're going to put you, dear Gwinnett, we're going to put you in a literal boycott.
Not love, that we saw.
Love Live Nation.
Not that we saw.
That, to our knowledge, doesn't.
And let me say Live Nation's defense at this.
Yeah.
So there's two venues. There's the Gwinnett, which is slightly outside Atlanta, and then there's an amphitheater whose name has changed. I apologize, I forget the name of it. But the amphitheater's bigger. And Live Nation said, well, we went there because it sold more tickets.
Matchbox 20's popping.
Yeah, and they played amphitheaters on other dates on their tour.
Yeah.
But, that's true. But you still have the guy running the venue saying, why are you doing this to us?
Right,
don't
and
abandon
also we
us.
Were told that this yes. is basically, we're going to boycott you. Is this happening in other places?
Yes. We included a few other anecdotes in the story.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of venues that AEG has complained about to the Justice Department.
Mm-hmm. Specifics.
Yes. Yeah. But then there's several others that they were not the complaining party and some that they didn't have anything to do with. So once we started collecting this information, we interviewed AEG. They gave us some documents. But we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a matter of a competitor spinning us to beat up on
yeah,
Live Nation.
Of course.
And so we did do a lot of reporting on this. We spoke to many others. We spoke to other promoters, other ticketing companies, others in the business. Some of it we put in the story, and we were pretty satisfied that this seems to be happening
in
a recurring pattern all over the country.
Can we talk about two groups of sort of two parties to this entire situation that we haven't really talked about yet? One is consumers, and the other is artists.
Mm-hmm.
For consumers, how would they experience the change that the merger brought about and the sort of potential in the pushback? And for artists, you know, I'm old enough to remember the days of Pearl Jam being super mad at Ticketmaster and people just really, really resenting fees. I don't know if that's really an operative thing in the sort of consumer space right now, but I also don't know what's happening with artists. I don't know if artists are trying to work outside of these formal systems, and if so, are any pushing back against the consolidation that we're seeing?
It's a little tricky, but I think that one general complaint that people have about the music industry and that affects consumers is, why are the prices so high? Why are ticket prices so high, and why are fees so high? How are they justified? Live Nation and Ticketmaster, I think because they're the biggest target, get beat up about this a lot. But I don't think it can all be pinned on them. However, I think because of the merger, they have no incentive to lower those prices. And in fact, when the company gives their presentations to Wall Street and they report their earnings, they talk about things like how their secondary market ticket sales are climbing. They talk about the idea that you're booking a tour with an artist, and last year they were selling their ticket for $200. But look, their tickets are being resold on StubHub for $800.
Right.
So maybe you can get them to raise the price to $250, $260.
Yeah.
So raising the prices generally is just part of the pressure that's on the industry overall.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really very little reason for anybody to lower the prices.
Yeah. I mean, especially for shows that have demonstrated demand, it just seems
– right.
I don't know. Maybe I'm a little inured to it at this point in my concert-going life.
How many tickets are you buying?
Yeah, John? To be fair, we don't buy a lot of tickets, but, you know, I see the prices on them, but I'm a little bit inured to it. You know, I did recently buy some Hamilton tickets, and they were expensive AF.
Yeah.
But if I ever have to flip them on StubHub, holla.
So the secondary market of tickets is a huge, huge issue. I wish we could have gone into it in this story, but it's such a big issue that we wanted to keep it separate and we wanted to have a little more focus. One of the big problems that's hit the concert industry in general is like what to do about ticket scalping.
Yeah, sure.
On the one hand, it's really good because it does mean it's easier to get those tickets once they've been sold and you don't have to like hang out behind the venue and get ripped off or something. Places like StubHub have really like legitimized that process, and they're basically pretty trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they've tended to push prices through the roof.
Of course.
At least for most of the concerts and events that anybody cares about.
Although just from a purely economic point of view, isn't it more reflective of actual demand and actual, like, you know, this kind of like fluid pricing system?
You would think I personally think it's more complicated than that. Mm. I think that the big scalpers and the bot systems and stuff have ways to manipulate that supply.
Adam Smith was wrong?
Adam Smith was wrong about this one. But
yo!
If he had lived to see – I mean, he wasn't wrong because if it really was a perfect market, it would reflect demand.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, he didn't know about bots. Right?
If you take one thing away from this podcast, that Adam Smith didn't know about bots – true story.
Yeah.
He couldn't have anticipated bots. I mean, he could have, but he didn't. And he was whack because of it. Adam Smith, you're canceled.
A few years ago, the New York Attorney General did a report about ticket scalping.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they found was that there's a very high number of tickets held. And what that means is when a concert goes on sale, they don't sell 100% of the tickets.
Right.
There's some that are held back for season ticket holders, that are some for those sponsor deals.
Yep.
Like when it says, you know, American Express cardholders, you get to buy your ticket 3 days in advance. Citibank, you get to get your ticket 3 days in advance. And record labels, especially here in places like New York and LA, they will buy blocks of tickets for themselves. But what that means is that there's a huge chunk of the house that is not going on sale to the general public. Mm-hmm. And then what happens with those tickets is mysterious because there's a lot of forces that want to get their hands on those tickets and that can flip them quickly. Recently here, there have been some serious criminal charges against people in like Ponzi scheme mm-hmm. ticketing deals. How those tickets get on the secondary market, I think, is very opaque. And I think there is a great deal of incentive for people to manipulate how that goes so that there's only X number of tickets up on StubHub or on one of these other sites at one time, which tends to put the prices up, and then you put a few more on, and then a week later you put some more on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that happens. I don't think it's a perfect market.
Let's talk about artists. Let's talk about, are artists making more or less money with the current setup? And is there anyone who's pushing back against the system?
They are making more money under the current system.
Okay.
And there's very few, if any, artists pushing against this. The concert industry is booming. The ticketing industry is booming. The secondary market is booming. Nobody wants to stop that gravy train. And part of what happens is when you have a system that's continually pushing prices up and up and up, and artists are having a harder time making money from their recordings, they're on the road more, especially for major artists. They're getting paid huge amounts of money as advances to go on tour. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Who's paying them the advance?
Live Nation pays the biggest advances.
Okay.
AEG is also in this business buying tours. They do Justin Bieber. They do Taylor Swift. They do Kenny Chesney. Mm-hmm. They do Paul McCartney. Part of the way that big tours happen is Live Nation or AEG or a small number of others essentially bid for the right to put on the whole tour. And what that does is creates one huge payday for the artist.
So they're paying upfront.
They're paying upfront.
In the same way that a record label would pay in advance.
Yes. And then they collect everything on the back end.
Got it.
Those advances are gigantic when you're talking about major artists who can sell out major
venues.
Tens
of millions of
dollars. Tens of millions, even over 100, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not complaining. I think there is a little bit of disillusionment about just how much everybody has to tour. When Tom Petty died, he had just finished a tour, and there was a Grammy event where Stevie Nicks was saying he should have canceled his tour. He wasn't well, but he had to tour. And he was not the kind of guy that would ever give up. You know, she said something like that.
Right, right, right.
But there is a general dissatisfaction about how much you have to tour. I don't think that's Live Nation's fault,
You mean to earn the biggest amount of money, or you mean specific to – in order to get a deal with a Live Nation, the level of commitment required is very high.
I think to make your money, you have to tour. And you have to agree to really tour.
So these tours, these are where artists are making a tremendous amount of money. And obviously one of the signature things of the last decade in the record business is that artists are making seemingly less and less money from the recorded music, whether it's because of declining sales or because the amount of money that streaming generates has not yet caught up to what the CD heyday, as it were. And that's moved closer to the center of the conversation because Spotify has finally gone public.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about that. And I actually want to start before we get to the actual public offering. There was a thing that happened on the first day of sales, which is that Sony, who obviously owns a piece of Spotify, let go of, I don't remember how much. How much did they let go?
It was like 17% of what they had.
Mm-hmm. They subsequently said they are going to pay some of the millions of dollars, hundreds of millions.
We'll see.
A lot of money. They let a lot of shares go. Some of that money is going to go back to artists, although they did not specify. So it made me think two things. One, what does Sony really think about the future of Spotify if they were going to let go of that much on day one? And two, what obligations do they have contractually to their artists vis-a-vis Spotify money?
This is one where the answer is going to be a little more complicated than it's probably necessary. So
indulge me. All good.
They didn't sell 100%. It was interesting that they only sold 17%.
Right.
It made them about $250, $260 million. It depends on when they did it exactly. I'm not sure why they only did that much, but one guess is that all of the big record companies own stakes in Spotify. They got these as a condition of giving them licensing deals back in the day. And it appears that Sony bought more along the way to keep their percentage up.
Oh, before the offering.
Before the offering. It looks like, in addition to simply being granted shares in their deals, they may have bought more. When Spotify put out their prospectus, all their disclosure information about it, Sony was the only label that was listed there because there's a threshold about what has to be reported. Investors have to be above a certain level for them to be included on the list there of who are the major shareholders.
Do we know what the threshold is?
I believe the threshold's about 5%.
So that means that
they were at like 5.2 or something or
so rather. Universal Music Group, who else would
Universal,
it be?
Warner. Merlin, which is like an indie consortium. Mm-hmm. We know that they have stakes. There's other various, like, there are artist managers and various other parties in the music business that have stakes or at least have had stakes in Spotify. Mm-hmm. So by getting rid of 17% of what they had, I think it takes them under the threshold. So that may be one reason why they did that and why they did it the way they did it. Mm-hmm. But it's not just a Sony thing. All the big labels face a weird choice right now about what to do with that. Because they got these partly as like an insurance policy that they didn't know if Spotify was going to succeed. But if it did, they wanted to make sure that they got something out of it.
And that they were sort of mutually invested, basically.
Yes. Some people see that as a conflict of interest,
right.
But yes.
It does feel that way a little bit. But okay, so then let's hypothetical it out, right? What if Sony sold 100%?
Mm-hmm.
Is it much easier then for Sony to be like, well, we don't own part of you anymore, so we can pull our music?
Yes. It would. But the fact that they're now big enough to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange makes it that much harder for them to pull their
music out. Sure. But as a negotiating tactic, that is conceptually on the table as a tactic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I would say so.
Is that something that people speak about openly?
I think we're past that point.
Okay.
I don't see any of them pulling their music. For example, Universal was actually out of its deal for almost 2 years where they were going month to month with Spotify until they re-upped some point early last year.
Okay.
And I think that kind of showed that Universal blinked on that. They, you know, letting a deal lapse is kind of a sign that you could pull your content out, but they never did it. They just – because they're getting huge amounts of money. The big labels are making literally billions of dollars from Spotify. And they're paying that – some of that out in royalties, but they're also collecting it.
The reason Sony was able to sell so much on this first day was partially because the offering was not a traditional IPO, correct?
Yes.
Can you explain the difference between what Spotify did and what an ordinary IPO? This is a direct offering.
Yeah, it's direct listing. So usually when there's an IPO, what happens is a company sells new shares. They say, we're making up a 500 million shares and we're putting them on the stock market and they're now for sale and people can buy them. And that's how they raise money. So the day before they went public, they may have had 10 million shares that were divided among their investors. The next day there's 500 million shares and they sell them and they make that money and then they use that to grow and do whatever. What Spotify did was issue no new shares.
So the only shares that were available for sale that day were shares that
already existed.
Stakeholders
yes.
already had.
So there's a lot of investors. They also pay their employees in shares.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know all the details there, but like lots of tech companies, they've mm-hmm. done that. There are lots of employees, lots of executives who are sitting on shares.
Yes.
This gives them an easy way to sell it. Speaking of secondary markets, there was a secondary market for Spotify shares.
Prior to this.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know if your average person working there has access to that.
Got it.
But yes, this cut out a lot.
Yeah, that.
Doing it this way allowed them to cut out some of the red tape that usually happens on Wall Street with these things. There's banks that get in there. There's law firms that their services cost a lot of money to mm-hmm. the company. This also prevented the two guys who founded the company, Daniel Ek and Martin Lorentzen. It prevented them from getting diluted.
Yes.
So they still, I believe, together they own something like 40%. Of the stock. Like the New York Times, they have a dual stock system.
Mm-hmm.
So they also have all the controlling shares.
Right.
So there's no way anybody can buy up a lot of stock and take it away from them.
Right. So if you're buying Spotify stock, you're only buying into the idea that the company will do well.
You're buying the steerage shares, yeah.
Right, exactly. So again, not to come back to artists, but what do artists stand to gain from this or not stand to gain from this? Because I sort of imagine when I read the story about Sony selling its share, mm-hmm. I kind of imagine them kind of like greedily like getting these sort of bags of gold doubloon and then going like, nah, and then like taking one off the top and like putting it in an artist's like Citibank checking account.
Well, in the beginning when the labels got these equity stakes, the big question was about conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. It was like, how do I know you're getting the best royalty rate for me if you're also an investor and you stand to make money once they go public? That eventually turned to, okay, when they do go public, what are you going to do with all those shares? And am I going to get any of that money, right?
Like, and no artist has shares, right?
I don't believe so, but right. It's possible.
Like, I mean like they may have shares on their own, but I mean like through the system in which Sony and Warner and Universal have shares.
I don't know.
Maybe they have a deal. Like, maybe someone has a deal where it's like I get 0% of your 0%. But like, who knows?
A lot of high profile artists have had big launches there. I mean, it's possible. Sure. I don't know.
Okay. All right.
But eventually the question became like, what are you going to do with those shares and am I going to make any money? Because unlike a typical investor, you didn't pay for them, most of them, and just get them. You used my music
as leverage
to get them. Yeah. So the labels then got into a situation where there's not a contractual rule about what has to happen here, because the artist contracts say, you know, when you sell my music, you got to pay me this much money. But they usually don't say something like, when you have an investment and you sell it, you owe me such and such.
Right.
But I think for the purpose of avoiding bad PR, the labels have pretty much settled onto an idea that when they sell, they're going to share the profits with artists based on some kind of calculation around their royalties.
Sure.
So let's say they sell their shares and they get $1 billion. Some of that money, if they've bought, they're going to have to take some of that out. There may be taxes. There may be other deductions that go in there. And then they're left with another pot of money. Let's say it's $750 million. What they're then going to do is they're going to have to decide, our artists accounted for this many streams over the last X number of years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Drake, you're responsible for 1% of those streams. So 1% of the 750 million
goes to you.
Should go to you according to your royalty rate. Meaning, so you don't get 1% of the 750 million. Maybe you get 20% of 1% of the 750.
And then what happens with the other 80%?
Goes into the pockets of the Monopoly guy.
I'm in the wrong business, man. The finesse is so real. Let's just go get a quick JD MBA real fast and then just have a beautiful home.
Also, as you may know.
Also, my home's beautiful. I just want to specify. I want to clarify. My home is nice.
As you may know, John, a lot of artists are not recouped on record deals.
Sure.
So that means that the label doesn't have to pay them. And what that
they
what,
can pay it against the recoup, but like
they'll pay it against the recoup, yeah. But it means they don't have to pay out the cash. What that means is when you're signed to a label, you get an advance, mm-hmm. and you don't get another dollar until the label makes back that money.
Right.
So a huge number of the artists under contract are going to be unrecouped.
How do you feel about the future of journalism being us having to recoup our salaries? How do you feel about that?
I feel like I'm doing that every day.
Please subscribe to the podcast. Please. My life depends on it. So you sent me an article a couple days ago in Recode talking about potential long-term Spotify plans.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting because what we've just been talking about are the ways in which artists and labels are entangled together in a way that can be not detrimental to artists, but can be challenging for artists to make money. They're getting money up front, but they're not getting necessarily all the pieces of all the things at the level that they might like.
Mm-hmm.
So an interesting thing has been happening over the last couple of years, which is artists are cutting side deals directly with platforms, with distribution platforms,
mm-hmm.
largely with Apple. Apple seemed to really jump out in front on this a couple of years ago. You sent me an article from Recode that indicated a potential strategy for Spotify would be to do sort of a similar thing, but not with top of the list A-list artists, but with, I want to say, the B-team. Does that seem fair?
I think it could be the A-team too.
Okay.
I think what you're getting at is that Spotify pays most of its money to the record companies and the industry, and their margins are pretty thin.
Yeah.
And now that they're public and now that they're like under the microscope of Wall Street, They got to make more money. They got to get their margins bigger.
And that article, I believe, said that they were shooting for a 35% margin and that they're only currently at around 20.
That's right. And I think that's their operating margin, which is different from really like the bottom line, because the bottom line is they're actually not profitable. They lose money. So Spotify needs to figure out how to make more money and how to pay less for the music that they have on the service. They're probably not going to get the labels to reduce their fees anymore. Mm-hmm. One way they can do this is by making deals with various kinds of artists to get content onto the system that is either cheaper to get there or they don't have to pay royalties for it.
Right. Is more profitable one way or the other.
Yes. So there's going to be probably things like video, podcasts, maybe sessions. It could be all kinds of things.
Recently, both Taylor Swift and The Weeknd came through on Spotify with vertical videos for your phone.
Yeah.
Which are just like videos, but they're thinner. So that happened.
I think they're kind of neat. I liked Sam Smith's vertical video,
too. I missed that.
I think it was one of the first ones. I think that it's making the record companies nervous because their purpose now is sort of being called into question. This is what we saw with Frank Ocean.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't the first person to do it, but in the streaming age, that was kind of a big wake-up call, I think.
Yeah.
Was that a label would look at that and say, we spent all this money kind of propping up an artist and making them famous and buying ads and billboards and paying for studios and stuff. And then this guy like just sort of takes his music and walks out the front door and makes a deal with Apple. That's a threatening thing to the business model that the major labels have.
Right. Also the emotional model of the major label, which is you are forever indebted to us and you should never do anything that would indicate that you do anything other than love mommy and daddy.
So once Frank Ocean did this.
Speaking of Frank, where's my Endless VHS? Where's that?
Oh,
it hasn't shown up yet. I don't think anybody's has shown up.
Did you actually buy?
Of course. I support. Got merch out here. So yes, but I don't think the Endless stuff has shown up yet. But I'm excited. I'm excited to also buy a VCR to play the Endless VHS. Speaking of Frank, speaking of Endless, let's listen to Hugh Blows from Frank Ocean's Endless, a song that appeared on the internet without a record label, but in a distribution platform, and hopefully eventually on a VHS tape in my home.
So I think the relationship between Spotify and the labels is a little fraught.
Yeah.
It has been for a while. I think right now there's peace because there was an IPO, money was made. Spotify still needs them and doesn't want to upset them too much. But the labels are sort of looking at the other side and saying, are they going to start messing with us?
What do you think?
I think that they're going to have to.
Yeah.
And they basically said this already.
Yeah.
They want to do more podcasts. They want to do other kinds of content. And I think it makes sense for Spotify to do that.
We know why an artist like Frank Ocean can do what he did. And even someone like Chance the Rapper, who has yet to sign to a major label, or at least that we know of. But, you know, he went straight to Apple for the most recent record. Now, I know not everybody is that famous. Not everybody has that built-in fan base. But if Spotify starts saying, or Apple, whoever, starts saying to these artists, yes, we can work with you if you have 1 million fans, but we can also work with you if you have 100,000 fans, at what point does the label truly start to not matter? Because the label functions, a lot of label functions, obviously are handled either more effectively on the internet or are being taken in by the artists themselves. Like, you know, an artist on social media is often as effective as any promotion strategy that a label will think up on their behalf. So do you see it? Is there a tipping point kind of like on the way, on the horizon?
I wonder about that because I feel like we've been asking this question about record labels for a long time.
Sure.
This did not come up with Spotify. It didn't come up with streaming. This was the question people were asking in the early days of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And the prediction has been there for like 20 years that record labels are eventually just going to sort of topple into the sea. They're not going to matter anymore. But what we've seen over the last 10 years or so is that they've consolidated. They've gotten a lot more powerful in many ways. They still do something very important, signing the acts and promoting them and getting them on the radio. But I think the getting them on the radio part might start to fade. Getting them on Spotify is going to become the new getting them on the radio.
Sure.
And Spotify is going to be doing that themselves, and the artist's managers are going to be doing that themselves. I think there's going to be more and more pressure on the labels about this in the near future. But I just feel like the obituary for the record labels has been written so many times and it's never come true. And I don't really buy that that's ever really going to happen. What they've really become is like owners of gigantic numbers of copyrights. They're owners of content. And, you know, Spotify might go away. Spotify might get bought by Google or Facebook or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just going to be another like Silicon Valley versus content kind of a situation.
Right.
So I'm not really expecting the labels to disappear, but I think they're going to need to change some of their model.
Can I just say before we go, in that moment when you said Spotify may go away, you reminded me a lot of the promos that Spike Jonze did for Viceland, the TV network, right when that launched.
Mm.
He was being very philosophical and he's like, someday this building will be something else. It used to be a factory and now it's this, and then someday it'll be something else. And as we know, the only thing that lasts over time is copyright. Sony made a bunch of money from Spotify. So let's play something off the Sony Music Group, an artist I would be thrilled if he got 47 cents out of that big Spotify sale from Sony. Let's play the new ASAP Rocky single. And this is called ASAP Forever, featuring your boy Moby.
Moby?
Yes.
Gang.
That's our show this week. Thank you to Ben Cesario for breaking down the biggest of big business. Appreciate it. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Subscribe to us at Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes, all these places that are squeezing your favorite artists for their last dime. But by all means, subscribe to the podcast.
But giving them exposed.
Absolutely. They're wild exposed. They're getting super burned. They're the color of my shirt. That's how exposed they are. Email us if you have any questions or if you have any secrets. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. If you want to deep throat something to Ben, I'll forward the email if you want to give up the goods. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, and we will be back next week.
My eyes like the stars. I tell them, cover your eyes, because when me, you go blind. She losing her mind. We kiss the Frank Ocean and blind, convincing my go blonde. Was born in the dark. I kid you, you open my blinds. On yams, and that's worth of my mom. Small jail and mammon with cases I'm still trying to beat. A bunch of from a long time ago. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. Like dominoes, the rhinomos. When it's my time to go, adios, dominoes. Like a no Dominicano, but eat the toast. On this, we're plotting those. Dealing with life in its highs and lows. I'm just spinning like I'm supposed to.